ist der IS im Irak tatsächlich besiegt? Mein Name ist Robert Chatterjee. Ich bin stellvertretender Chefredakteur des Magazins Zenit und wir sind kürzlich dieser Schicksalsfrage des Irak nachgegangen. Nicht in unserem Magazin, sondern auf dem Podium, mitten in Berlin. Monday on the Couch. Gemeinsam mit der Robert-Bosch-Stiftung haben wir Munkith Dare zum Gespräch geladen. Dares Geschäft sind Meinungen, und zwar die der Iraker. Ein gefährlicher Job. Der Demoskop hat schon einige Mitstreiter verloren, denn seine Teams operieren auch in Gebieten unter Kontrolle von gewaltbereiten Dschihadisten. Doch Munkith Dare will gerade herausfinden, wie die Menschen in Städten wie Mosul denken und ob sie Organisationen wie den IS wirklich unterstützen. Im Gespräch mit Zenit-Chefredakteur Daniel Gerlach stellte Dare auf Englisch neueste Umfrageergebnisse vor und ging der Frage nach, schafft der IS im Irak ein Comeback? Doch zu Beginn wollten wir von unserem Gast etwas über die aktuelle Lage im Irak erfahren. Denn auch 4 Monate nach den Parlamentswahlen hat das Land noch immer keine Regierung. Wie stehen also die Chancen, dass sich daran bald etwas ändert?
It is very complicated, as usual. As usual, this is not the first time. This is the 4th government established in this way. And every time we have in Iraq what we or some politicians in Iraq name it as 11-hour policy, which means that we reach a decision just a few minutes before the 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So this is always happening in Iraq. All what you read right now, lists, etc., this guy will be that, it's not decided yet. As I put in my presentation, we have 4 different powers right now affecting the dynamics of composing the new government. The first power or the first dynamic is the U.S.-Iranian battle.
Shadow war, competition.
Shadow war, proxy war.
Which you see is already going on in Iraq heavily.
For sure, for sure. So this is part of the entire war between U.S. administration and the Iranian regime. Iranian regime is trying to make it in a different countries, and Iraq, one of these countries which has been used to defeat United States in it, or at least to reach a better deal for Iran. So this is the first thing. We have a second dynamic, which is the clergy struggle or fight, or name it what you want to name it, between the Najaf clergy and Qom clergy.
So we should probably explain that a little bit. Najaf being the religious capital, let's say, of Iraq, where the Shia Marja'iyya, the Shia leadership, has created its universities and schools. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, Qom in Iran, which is like the big contender dominating the Shia world. Yeah.
They are competing. And the real competition is on resources, by the way. It's not a religious way. It's on resources, because it is known in the Shia beliefs that the supreme leader, or al-marja', what they call it, al-marja', or the highest cleric, will get what they call it al-khumis. Mm-hmm. Al-khumis, or the one-fifth, because Shias believe that they have to donate fifth of their total income to the highest cleric.
You know, in Germany, we call it Kirchensteuer. It's basically a tax that is raised for the churches by the German government. So we are familiar with that system.
So they are competing, because this means billions of dollars. So we have a hidden struggle between both. And this is going back in history to hundreds of years. So this is the second power struggling. We have also Shias, and Sunnis, and Kurds. For the first time, Shias are not unified. Sunnis are not unified. Kurds are not unified. There is inter and intra struggle between all these. All these things makes things very complicated. It's very difficult to say how things will go on I use a term always. At the last moment, we have someone coming in the parachutes and from the Mars as the Prime Minister of Iraq. But what is more interesting for us for this evening, which is focus on Daesh reappearance, I think we have three possible scenarios right now. The first and best possible scenario is to have a government, balanced government, which can make both US and Iran satisfy and can keep a balance between both of them. And to have such government, you need a real good prime minister with good relation with both United States, Iran, and accepted by the clergy as well. If this happens, then the possibility of the reappearance of Daesh is very low. This is the best scenario. The second best scenario is we have a government which is more biased, let us say, put it in that, this way, to US. This will give us a good government, not strong government. It will have a lot of opposition. It will have a lot of problems. But at the same time, it will have the support of the West. Because right now, in these areas which were controlled by Daesh, we have a huge destruction. We need a real big construction workshop. And this needs a lot of money. So we need the help of the West. We need the help of the US. And we need the help of the World Bank, all other donors, the Gulf countries. These won't donate, won't help if there is a pro-Iranian government, which is the third scenario. The third worst scenario we have, if we have or we end up with a very pure pro-Iranian government. A pure pro-Iranian government give us the highest possibility of Daesh reappearance because it will justify the propaganda of Daesh. Right now, Daesh using different kind of propaganda, and I can claim that I am one of the experts in Daesh. I dedicated most of my research for the last 4 years to understand Daesh and people who lives under Daesh, even when Daesh was controlling Mosul, etc. I had my teams working there, reporting to me what's going on. And finally, the last year, the Iraqi authorities gave me an access to these captured terrorists. I spent more than 2 weeks in one of the Iraqi prisons in Baghdad, interviewing more than 43 of these terrorists.
And what is it that you learned from these interviews? And what is it that you mentioned Daesh might exploit this situation, this new biased, strongly pro-Iranian government for its own benefit? And what is the propaganda narrative that is so dangerous in your opinion?
Thank you for this question. Because I recall the first interview I made, it was with one of these clerics who was the mentor of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in the jail. And he had a higher education than Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi at that time. And when I met him, when I interviewed him, the first thing after he understood why I'm interested in interviewing him, the first thing he did, he asked me a question. He said, have you ever asked yourself why we, and by we he means ISIS, Daesh, why we were so successful in recruiting hundreds of thousands of young people in a very short time, and we were able to control a huge territory in a very short time, while our Al-Qaeda mother, he named it our mother in ideology, Al-Qaeda, has been there and working since 1990s. Till now, they were not able to recruit more than hundreds of people, and they were not able to control what we controlled.
I'm sure you had an answer to the question, can you imagine why we were so successful? What was your answer and what is it today?
As a professional moderator, usually when I receive such question, I ask the interviewees, what do you think or why? So I let him speak about it. He said, and he really flagged out a very interesting point. He said Al-Qaeda was recruiting or focusing in its recruitment on those who believe in its ideology. So all these crazy Islamists, jihadists, fundamentalists, Wahhabists, etc., all these are the main focus of Al-Qaeda. For us, we don't care whether this guy is a real Muslim or not a real Muslim. We have some people who came from Europe and they don't know even Al-Fatiha, Surah Al-Fatiha, the first version in Quran.
Which is very short, not so difficult to memorize.
So we don't care. We recruited every single one who has a reason to fight against United States or the West or the central government, regardless of whether he is a real believer or not a real believer. So Daesh is not a religious fundamentalist organization. That's why, going back to your question, they use different kind of propaganda. For instance, we are here to protect Sunnis against Shia. We are here to protect you from Iran, from the Persians. So when we have a pro-Iranian government, you will give them all the rights to all the justification for their holy war, to start again their holy war.
Now, the Iranians would probably argue if you give them a pro-American government, it's going to be quite the same.
Well, according at least to my public opinion surveys, when we ask these areas, the Sunnis areas, and we do that since 2003 till now, we have asked this question more than 200 times, the favorability of different countries. And if you see the favorability of United States, it was almost zero on 2003 among Sunnis. This started to go up, 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 up. Right now, in Sunnis areas, United States is one of the most favorable countries. Versus in Iran, you have a steady line with very low support. And this is not because Sunnis love Americans or like Americans. This is just because Sunnis believe that it is the only counter power to the Iranian influence. And for them, Iranian influence is the worst sin in the world. This argument is incorrect, and they are trying to say that without Iran, you cannot survive.
I just want to take the attention of our audience to what it actually means to do polling on these matters in a country like Iraq. You're aware, like when we are calling, when pollsters in Germany call just ahead of elections and ask, like, would you vote for AfD? the right-wing conservative party, which is on the rise in this country, apparently. People don't give honest answers they would say, because they feel, sometimes they feel even embarrassed about their own political opinion, so they wouldn't even admit. This is at least what pollsters have found out. This is why also they have issues with the accuracy of the polls. Now, if I call I'm a pollster and I call somebody in Iraq and I say, hey, would you support Daesh if there was an Iranian government, a pro-Iranian government in Baghdad? What answer do you think people would give? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to jail or even be killed for an honest answer. Yes. So how, Monqit, have you been working? And maybe you can also give us, since you have been working for the last 15 years in Iraq, yes, the war has been going on for quite some time, yes, not only with the appearance of this Daesh, but yes, also the previous, yes, Islamic State in Iraq. So what is the reality of a pollster in this very specific context?
I recall on April, end of April 2003, when I asked my partners to do the first poll in Baghdad, they asked me, what do you mean by poll? So I've tried to explain to them, what does I mean by poll? Going to households, knocking the door, mm-hmm, asking, choosing the respondent, and asking some questions. So one of my friends, he came to me and he put his hand on my, he said, are you sick, Monqit, are you sick? Are you crazy? Do you want us to go to people and ask them? And we made it. Eventually we made it. All our interviews are face-to-face interviews. All of it is done according to the real international standards. Of course, this did not come without sufferings. I lost three of my interviewers who had been beheaded on 2007. I had a team captured by Al-Zarqawi at that time, and those who knows Al-Zarqawi knows how he was.
Maybe you want to just like briefly remind all the audience that we are on the same level, who Zarqawi was. I'm sure everybody has heard the name.
Al-Zarqawi was the founder of Al-Qaeda in Bilad al-Rafidain, Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. He was the first emir or the first prince of Al-Qaeda, and he is a Jordanian. And he was the mentor, real mentor, of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
So at that time when his organization was operating in Iraq, your people were
captured by, yes, and they torched severely. Also, my teams captured by different militias, by the government. So we had a lot of things, but we insisted on giving the real answers to and the real voice of Iraqis to the world. Right now, we are working, when we send our interviewers, they have their own tablets, they work, and we can track them by the GPS, we can audio record every single interview, listen to it, verify it. So,
and are people in the, let's say, disenfranchised areas of Iraq, which are vulnerable to Daesh propaganda and Daesh activities, are they freely answering the questions?
It's not freely. In public opinion, professional, and by the way, I'm the vice president of Gallup International. I'm in charge of MENA region, those who knows Gallup or heard about Gallup.
We don't have to explain Gallup, opposed to Zarqawi.
Yeah, I'm in charge of Middle East and North Africa region, the vice president. So it's not a real science. It's a mixture of science and arts. And you cannot say that these answers are 100% accurate. But as we define the poll, we call the public opinion survey, it's a snapshot. Snapshots alone cannot give you a real answer, but when you put these snapshots for 15 years, one beside other, and you start to check the trend. Right now I have, for instance, what I call ISIS dashboard. So we have created some indexes for each index of 3-4 questions, and we trace it, and we see how it go up, down, everything is interpreted. People, not 100% of them are very frank, but at least you have the majority.
When Daesh emerged, of course, obviously did not emerge, but the international public became aware of it, let's say sometime between 2013 and 2014. Were you able, from a pollster's perspective, to somehow to predict this development?
On the 10th of June 2014, Daesh controlled Mosul on 9th of June 2014. So on the 10th of June 2014, I called my people in Mosul and other Sunni areas. What's going on? Tell me what's going on. They say that it is a popular revolution. People are protesting. People, no one identified Daesh. So I initiated a survey. But at the same time, I went back to see the surveys which I did in this area during the last couple months, and all of it on my computers. When I saw it and I saw the answers, I said, oh God, why I didn't take care of that? It's very clear that there was, of course, I cannot say that Daesh will take over, but it was so clear that this area has something wrong. For sure, it's when you compare it with other Iraqi areas, the difference is so high, which means that this area is suffering. This is why I say that Daesh was not the cancer. It wasn't the disease, it was a symptom of a disease. The disease is there in that area. The environment was so healthy for Daesh to grow up in it. So right now, this teaches me a lesson to keep a close eye on these indicators. And right now, I'm tracing these indicators to understand. This is why I have a big fear. I'm so worried that Daesh or similar organization can reappear, and it will not take a long time to reappear unless there is a real solution. As I've told you, it's not a religious phenomenon. It is a socio-political issue. Unless these socio-political issues solved, then definitely Daesh, or even worse than Daesh, when Daesh appeared, Al-Qaeda for us was like angels in comparison with Daesh.
But we can come to that point, the role of the United States in, or the negligence, let's say, the perceived negligence, let's put it this way, of the United States in this emergence, in this critical moment when Daesh became so powerful.
As you just mentioned, I clearly underline the fact that we need a very balanced government. It's not good for Iraq to be under U.S. influence or Iranian influence, but this is the fact, actually, right now. My favorability for, as I put it, the second choice for a U.S., not Iranian, not pro-Iranian. Because for Daesh, if we are focusing on Daesh, and for Sunnis, we are not talking about other area, other things. If you go now and ask people about to compare U.S., and Iran, they will immediately answer U.S., not Iran.
And Trump has not changed that equation?
No. No. No, no, no. One of the principles that you learn when you start working in public opinion survey, we intellectuals tend to think that people are thinking in the same way that we are thinking. Actually, they don't. I mean, when you ask them about Trump, they will say, huh? Who is Trump? We know it's Trump. They don't know Trump.
It is hard to imagine that anybody on this planet, like there's a person on this planet that would not know. But maybe it's like...
We are the... Those who are so engaged with their daily life, they don't understand the complexity of politics.
But they understand Shia Sunni.
Yes.
And why is that so? Apparently, for a long time, it didn't play such a decisive role in Iraqi daily life.
The U.S. made the biggest sin in the world for Iraqis when it really flamed this Sunnis, Shias thing. Actually, I cannot say that it wasn't there, but it was on a very low level.
I mean, you're from the city of Basra, which... some may remember, probably not from our generation, as, let's say, the Hamburg of yes. Iraq, like a trade city, very open, multicultural, many people from India, from all the Gulf area, South Asia. It was like a cultural melting pot. It is a majority Shia city, but according to most of the testimonies from previous times that I've heard, this Sunni-Shia issue was not there.
No.
So how come that it's so strong? Or do you see that maybe even in the polls, it's going down? People start to doubt the Sunni-Shia antagonism and try to overcome it. I don't know. Maybe you
this,
have some.
This is one of the positive things. Now, the last numbers that I have, people started to realize the artificial of this division between Sunnis and Shias. And according to many indicators that I have, people started to realize that it is not a big issue to be Sunnis or Shias. But as you said, in Basra, yes, many maybe don't believe that in 1960s, where I grew up, I was going to the swimming pool, swims with females, and I was going every Monday to a candlelight party in the club, and I was able to go and ask any lady to dance with me at that time. That was on 1960s. It's hard to believe right now if you say that, yeah?
Well, you presented in a very convincing manner.
That was the case. But there wasn't something. I mean, I am from a mixture family where we have both Sunnis and Shias. In the same families in Basra, you have two brothers from the same family, from the same father and mother. One of them is Sunni and one of them is Shia, because simply one of them, he chose to follow his mother sect, and the other chose to follow his father sect. They are brothers and they are lives together. They don't have anything with each other, playing with each other. But when they go to pray, this one pray in this way and that guy pray in that way. The first poll I did for the U.S. government, I recall two ladies wanted me to ask this question, whether you are Sunni or Shia. I say that no one. That was on 2003, July 2003. I say that people will reject to answer this question. I know my people, they don't believe in sectarianism at that time. Say, they say that you will not lose anything. Why you don't ask it? So I asked the question. And as I expected, around 75% of people, they refuse to answer the question. And they say that we are just Muslim, not Shia, neither Sunnis. On 2013, after a decade, I have been invited by Doha Institute in Qatar to have a presentation for a decade of the invasion. And I asked the same question. And guess what? I had 25% only who say that we are just Muslim, and 75 who revealed they're either Sunnis or Shias. So it's the opposite.
The opposite.
Totally the opposite. Right now it's going back. It's going back, which is one of the positive things about this year.
So can people only choose between Sunni and Shia, or can they also say I'm Sushi? I'm both. Which is actually a very common answer now. Yeah. People want to say, I am both, and I don't, like, my father is Shia, my mother is Sunni, so I'm Sushi. It's like,
officially, in Iraq, on 2013 or 12, I'm not sure, we had 38% of marriages are mixed marriages between Sunnis and Shias. That was till 2012 or 13, I'm not sure. It's going down for sure right now. It's not, but it is still very common. So Shias issues is more on the top level of politicians, and they used it to gain power. They used it to gain power. That's the only reason for them. For instance, Sunnis leaders were much worse than Shias leader on their people, and vice versa. Shias leaders were much worse on their people. Now Basra, take Basra as an example. Most of you maybe heard about Basra protest. Yes? What's going on right now in Basra? Basra is a Shia majority province, yet it suffered much worse than other, even Sunnis areas. Unemployment rate, the highest unemployment rate, which reached almost 40%, where it is not in Sunnis area, it is in Shia's area. It's in Dhiqar or in Nasriya. So the Shias politicians, they didn't serve their people. Sunnis politicians, they didn't serve their people. Actually, they used Shias and Sunnis as a justification to gain power and to share power and to divide the people. That's unfortunately the case. It's a real sad to know that because the governmental forces were not able to control Basra during the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Right now, Al-Hashd al-Sha'bi, or these militias, they created a new, they open the door for anyone to volunteer to be part of them, and they pay them. And you can imagine all these jobless young people, many of them will join. And now they create a new militia in Basra.
So we have like the phenomenon of like vigilante groups,
exactly.
Neighborhood watch. Do you see a parallel to the Iranian Basij
system?
It
is Basij. Yeah. It is the new Basij. Yeah. They call it the new Basij. So right now, and the first thing they started with capturing those activists, the civil activists. Right now, I call one of the top security leaders in Iraq, official leaders in Iraq. He is a friend, and he said that I don't know anything about them. So he don't know about these 40 young people captured. So the civil society is trying very hard, but they don't have the money. They don't have the armed forces. Many of them have been killed, assassinated. That's why they are facing a real tragedy.
But the clergy, or parts of the clergy, are siding with the protesters now. I've read a statement of Ahmad Safi, who is the spokesperson of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who was very outspoken and criticizing the government very harshly on this. Do you think they could swing? They could somehow influence the situation?
No. Again, this is out of the control of al-Najaf clergy. We said that we have two clergies struggling, Iran and Najaf. And Najaf is always, historically, Al-Najaf clergy was more close to the people for a simple reason. It's for economic reason, because they receive, as I've told you, 1/5 of their income. If these people are not happy with the clergy, then they will not give their money to them. That's why when they heard this protest, when they saw this protest, they had to be with it. But the militias here are not listening to the Najaf clergy. Militia is out of Najaf clergy control. That's why I don't expect that this will help a lot. A clergy has been used as an excuse to nominate someone or to reject someone.
Not even Grand Ayatollah Sistani himself. I mean, he told Iraqis in 2005, I believe, to go and vote, and they voted in large numbers. Don't you think that even his voice would count in this and would oblige the politicians to solve the situation in Basra?
I think from, and this is what I heard from a close people, that he regretted it. He regretted because this was among a few times where the clergy interfered directly in the political process. And for any clergy, if it interfere in the political process, it will lose a lot. And this happens. I'll give you different another example. The support for Ayatollah Sistani, we also gauge that level of support to Ayatollah Sistani from 2003 till now. It's still high, but it's going down. It's going down among...
And it's going down constantly.
Constantly, slowly, but constantly. Like Iran, both the support for Iran and the support for Ayatollah Sistani and for the clergy institution. We'll give you another example. On the World Values Surveys, which I conducted on 2014, the support for the religious institution among Shia was 76% support, 76%. Last month, I repeated the same survey, and the support was 60%. So almost they lost 17% in 4 years, which is significant, very significant.
Let's talk about the hopes. We have 2 minutes.
This is one of the hopes, the sectarian thing. Now, among Sunnis, 91%, they describe the relation between Sunni Arab and Shia Arab in Iraq today as a good relation, and 84%. Confidence in local police, now it's very high. Confidence in judicial system is very high. 80% of Iraqis think that having credible election is important. This is another thing which is a good sign. The support for Iran among Shia, as you can see, it was 75% on 2016. It declined right now to 44%, which is also a good sign. Thank you.